Yet every mayor could be pled for on the basis of what they came to call la única cosa, and that one thing which could absolve them of any but the grossest defect was an interest in cattle. For he'd broken the more promising mares to ride, and he'd taken them up country through the Cienega pasture, where the cows and calves stood in the lush grass along the edge of the marshlands, and he would show them the cows and let them move among them. And in the manada were mares who took a great interest in what they saw, and some would look back at the cows as they were ridden from the pasture. He claimed that cow sense could be bred for. The hacendado was less sure. But there were two things they agreed upon wholly, and that were never spoken, and that was that God had put horses on earth to work cattle, and that other than cattle there was no wealth proper to a man. They stabled the stallion away from the mares in a barn up at the Gerentes, and as the mares came into season, he and Antonio bred them. They bred mares almost daily for 3 weeks, and sometimes twice daily, and Antonio regarded the stallion with great reverence and great love, and he called him Caballo Padre, and like John Grady, he would talk to the horse and often make promises to him, and he never lied to the horse. The horse would hear him coming and set to walking about in the chaff on its hind legs, and he'd stand talking to the horse and describing to him the mares in his low voice. He never bred the horse at the same hour 2 days running, and he conspired with John Grady in telling the hacendado that the horse needed to be ridden to keep it manageable, because John Grady loved to ride the horse. In truth, he loved to be seen riding it. In truth, he loved for her to see him riding it. He'd go to the kitchen in the dark for his coffee and saddle the horse at daybreak with only the little desert doves waking in the orchard and the air still fresh and cool. And he and the stallion would come sideways out of the stable with the animal prancing and pounding the ground and arching its neck. They'd ride out along the Cienega road and along the verge of the marshes while the sun rose, riding up flights of ducks out of the shallows, or geese or mergansers that would beat away over the water, scattering the haze, and rising up would turn to birds of gold in a sun not yet visible from the Bolson floor. He'd ride sometimes clear to the upper end of the laguna before the horse would even stop trembling, and he spoke constantly to it in Spanish, in phrases almost biblical, repeating again and again the strictures of a yet untabled law. "Soy comandante de las yeguas," he would say, "yo y yo solo. Sin la caridad de estas manas no tengas nada, ni comida, ni agua, ni hijos. Soy yo que traigo las yeguas de las montañas, las yeguas jóvenes, las yeguas salvajes y ardientes." While inside the vaulting of the ribs between his knees, the darkly meated heart pumped of whose will, and the blood pulsed and the bowels shifted in their massive blue convolutions of whose will, and the stout thigh bones and knee and cannon and the tendons like flaxen hawsers that drew and flexed and drew and flexed at their articulations, and of whose will all sheathed and muffled in the flesh, and the hooves that stove wells in the morning ground mist, and the head turning side to side, and the great slavering keyboard of his teeth, and the hot globes of his eyes where the world burned. There were times in those early mornings in the kitchen when he returned to the house for his breakfast, with Maria stirring about and stoking with wood the great nickel-mounted cook stove or rolling out dough on the marble countertop, that he would hear her singing somewhere in the house, or smell the faintest breath of hyacinth, as if she'd passed in the outer hall. On mornings when Carlos was to butcher, he'd come up the walkway through a great convocation of cats, all sitting about on the tiles under the ramada, each in its ordered place, and he'd pick one up and stroke it, standing there at the patio gate through which he'd once seen her gathering limes, and he'd stand for a while holding the cat, and then let it slip to the tiles again, whereupon it would return at once to the spot from which it had been taken, and he would enter the kitchen and take off his hat. And sometimes she would ride in the mornings also, and he knew she was in the dining room across the hall by herself, and Carlos would take her breakfast tray to her with coffee and fruit. And once, riding in the low hills to the north, he'd seen her below on the Cienega Road, 2 miles distant. And he had seen her riding in the parkland above the marshes. And once he came upon her leading the horse through the shallows of the lakeshore among the tules, with her skirts caught up above her knees, while red-winged blackbirds circled and cried, pausing and bending and gathering white water lilies, with the black horse standing in the lake behind her, patient as a dog. He'd not spoken to her since the night of the dance at La Vega. She went with her father to Mexico, and he returned alone. There was no one he could ask about her. By now he'd taken to riding the stallion bareback, kicking off his boots and swinging up while Antonio still stood, holding the trembling mare by the twitch, the mare standing with her legs spread and her head down and the breath rifling in and out of her. Coming out of the barn with his bare heels under the horse's barrel, and the horse lathered and dripping and half-crazed and pounding up the Cienega Road, riding with just a rope hackamore, and the sweat of the horse and the smell of the mare on him, and the veins pulsing under the wet hide, and him leaning low along the horse's neck, talking to him softly and obscenely. It was in this condition that all unexpectedly one evening he came upon her, returning on the Black Arabian down the Cienega Road. He reined in the horse, and it stopped, and stood trembling, and stepped about in the road, slinging its head in a froth from side to side. She sat her horse. He took off his hat and passed his shirt sleeve across his forehead, and waved her forward, and put his hat back on, and reined the horse off the road and through the sedge, and turned so that he could watch her pass. She put the horse forward and came on, and as she came abreast of him, he touched the brim of his hat with his forefinger and nodded. And he thought she would go past, but she did not. She stopped and turned her wide face to him. He sat the sweating stallion like a highwayman under her gaze. She was waiting for him to speak, and afterwards he would try to remember what it was he'd said. He only knew it made her smile, and that had not been his intent. She turned and looked off across the lake where the late sun glinted, and she looked back at him and at the horse. "I want to ride him," she said. "What?" "I want to ride him." She regarded him levelly from under the black hat brim. He looked out across the sedge, tilting in the wind off the lake, as if there might be some help for him in that quarter. He looked at her. "When?" he said.
"When?"
"When did you want to ride him?"
"Now. I want to ride him now."
He looked down at the horse as if surprised to see it there.
"He don't have a saddle on."
"Yes," she said, "I know." He pressed the horse between his heels and at the same time pulled on the reins of the hackamore to make the horse appear uncertain and difficult, but the horse only stood.
"I don't know if the patron would want you to ride him, your father."
She smiled at him, a pitying smile, and there was no pity in it. She stepped to the ground and lifted the reins over the black horse's head and turned and stood looking at him with the reins behind her back. "Get down," she said.
"Are you sure about this?"
"Yes. Hurry." He slid to the ground. The insides of his trouser legs were hot and wet.
"What do you aim to do with your horse?"
"I want you to take him to the barn for me."
"Somebody will see me at the house."
"Take him to Armando's."
"You're fixing to get me in trouble."
"You are in trouble." She turned and looped the reins over the saddle horn and came forward and took the hackamore reins from him and put them up and turned and put one hand on his shoulder. He could feel his heart pumping. He bent and made a stirrup of his laced fingers and she put her boot into his hands and he lifted her and she swung up onto the stallion's back and looked down at him, and then booted the horse forward and went loping out up the track along the edge of the lake and was lost to view. He rode back slowly on the Arabian. The sun was a long time descending. He thought she might overtake him, that they could change the horses back again, but she did not. And in the red twilight he led the black horse past Armando's house afoot, and took it to the stable behind the house and removed the bridle and loosed the cinches and left it standing in the bay, saddled and tied with a rope halter to the hitching rail. There was no light on at the house, and he thought perhaps there was no one home. But as he walked back out down the drive past the house, the light came on in the kitchen. He walked more quickly. He heard the door open behind him, but he didn't turn to look back to see who it was, and whoever it was, they did not speak or call to him. The last time that he saw her before she returned to Mexico, she was coming down out of the mountains, riding very stately and erect out of a rain squall building to the north and the dark clouds towering above her. She rode with her hat pulled down in the front and fastened under her chin with a draw tie, and as she rode her black hair twisted and blew about her shoulders, and the lightning fell silently through the black clouds behind her. And she rode all seeming unaware down through the low hills, while the first spits of rain blew on the wind and onto the upper pasture lands and past the pale and reedy lakes, riding erect and stately, until the rain caught her up and shrouded her figure away in that wild summer landscape. Real horse, real rider, real land and sky, and yet a dream withal. The Dueña Alfonsa was both grand-aunt and godmother to the girl, and her life at the hacienda invested it with old-world ties and with antiquity and tradition. Save for the old leather-bound volumes, the books in the library were her books, and the piano was her piano. The ancient stereopticon in the parlor and the matched pair of greener guns in the Italian wardrobe in Don Hector's room had been her brother's. And it was her brother with whom she stood in the photos taken in front of cathedrals in the capitals of Europe. She and her sister-in-law in white summer clothes, her brother in vested suit and tie and Panama hat. His dark mustache, dark Spanish eyes, the stance of a grandee. The most antique of the several oil portraits in the parlor, with its dark patina crazed like an old porcelain glazing, was of her great-grandfather, and dated from Toledo in 1797. The most recent was she herself, full-length, in formal gown, on the occasion of her quinceañera at Rosario in 1892. John Grady had never seen her. Perhaps a figure glimpsed passing along the hallway. He did not know that she was aware of his existence until a week after the girl returned to Mexico he was invited to come to the house in the evening to play chess. When he showed up at the kitchen dressed in the new shirt and canvas pants, Maria was still washing the supper dishes. She turned and studied him where he stood with his hat in his hands. "Bueno," she said, "te espera." He thanked her and crossed the kitchen and went up the hall and stood in the dining room door. She rose from the table where she was sitting. She inclined her head very slightly. "Good evening," she said. "Please come in. I am Señorita Alfonsa." She was dressed in a dark gray skirt and a white pleated blouse, and her gray hair was gathered up behind, and she looked like the school teacher she in fact had been. She spoke with an English accent. She held out one hand, and he almost stepped forward to take it before he realized that she was gesturing toward the chair at her right. "Evening, ma'am," he said. "I'm John Grady Cole." "Please," she said, "be seated. I'm happy that you have come." "Thank you, ma'am." He pulled back the chair and sat and put his hat in the chair beside him and looked at the board. She set her thumbs against the edge and pushed it slightly towards him. The board was pieced from blocks of Circassian walnut and bird's-eye maple with a border of inlaid pearl, and the chessmen were of carved ivory and black horn. "My nephew will not play," she said. "I trounce him. Is it trounce?"
"Yes, ma'am, I believe it is."
Like him, she was left-handed, or she played chess with her left hand. The last two fingers were missing, and yet he did not notice it until the game was well advanced. Finally, when he took her queen, she conceded and smiled her compliments and gestured at the board with a certain impatience. They were well into the second game, and he had taken both knights and a bishop when she made two moves in succession which gave him pause. He studied the board. It occurred to him that she might be curious to know if he would throw the game, and he realized that he had, in fact, already considered it, and he knew she'd thought of it before he had. He sat back and looked at the board. She watched him. He leaned forward and moved his bishop and mated her in four moves.
"That was foolish of me," she said. "The Queen's knight. That was a blunder. You play very well."
"Yes, ma'am, you play well yourself." She pushed back the sleeve of her blouse to look at a small silver wristwatch. John Grady sat. It was 2 hours past his bedtime.
"One more?" she said.
"Yes, ma'am." She used an opening he'd not seen before. In the end, he lost his queen and conceded. She smiled and looked up at him. Carlos had entered with a tea tray, and he set it on the table, and she pushed aside the board and pulled the tray forward and set out the cups and saucers. There were slices of cake on a plate, and a plate of crackers, and several kinds of cheese, and a small bowl of brown sauce with a silver spoon in it.
"Do you take cream?" she said.
"No, ma'am." She nodded. She poured the tea.
"I could not use that opening again with such effect," she said.
"I'd never seen it before."
"Yes. It was invented by the Irish champion Pollock. He called it the King's Own Opening. I was afraid you might know it."
"I'd like to see it again sometime."
"Yes, of course."
She pushed the tray forward between them.
"Please," she said, "help yourself."
"I better not. I've crazy dreams eating this late."
She smiled. She unfolded a small linen napkin from off the tray. "I've always had strange dreams, but I'm afraid they're quite independent of my dining habits."
"Yes, ma'am."
"They have a long life, dreams. I have dreams now which I had as a young girl. They have an odd durability for something not quite real."
"Do you think they mean anything?" She looked surprised.
"Oh, yes," she said. "Don't you?"
"Well, I don't know. They're in your head."
She smiled again. "I suppose I don't consider that to be the condemnation you do. Where did you learn to play chess?"
"My father taught me."
"He must be a very good player."
"He was about the best I ever saw."
"Could you not win against him?"
"Sometimes. He was in the war, and after he came back I got to where I could beat him, but I don't think his heart was in it. He don't play at all now."
"That's a pity."
"Yes, ma'am, it is."
She poured their cups again. "I lost my fingers in a shooting accident," she said. "Shooting live pigeons. The right barrel burst. I was 17, Alejandra's age." "There's
nothing to be embarrassed about.
People are curious. It's only natural.
I'm going to guess that the scar on your cheek was put there by a horse."
"Yes, ma'am, it was my own fault." She watched him, not unkindly. She smiled. "Scars have the strange power to remind us that our past is real. The events that caused them can never be forgotten, can they?"
"No, ma'am."
"Alejandra will be in Mexico with her mother for 2 weeks. Then she will be here for the summer." He swallowed. "Whatever my appearance may suggest, I am not a particularly old-fashioned woman. Here we live in a small world, a close world. Alejandra and I disagree strongly, quite strongly, in fact. She is much like me at that age, and I seem at times to be struggling with my own past self. I was unhappy as a child for reasons that are no longer important. But the thing in which we are united, my niece and I..." She broke off. She set the cup and saucer to one side. The polished wood of the table held a round shape of breath where they'd stood that diminished from the edges in and vanished. She looked up. "I had no one to advise me, you see. Perhaps I would not have listened anyway. I grew up in a world of men. I thought this would have prepared me to live in a world of men, but it did not. I was also rebellious, and so I recognize it in others. Yet I think that I had no wish to break things, or perhaps only those things that wish to break me. The names of the entities that have power to constrain us change with time. Convention and authority are replaced by infirmity. But my attitude toward them has not changed. Has not changed. You see that I cannot help but be sympathetic to Alejandra, even at her worst. But I won't have her unhappy. I won't have her spoken ill of, or gossiped about. I know what that is. She thinks that she can toss her head and dismiss everything. In an ideal world, the gossip of the idle would be of no consequence. But I have seen the consequences in the real world, and they can be very grave indeed. They can be consequences of a gravity not excluding bloodshed, not excluding death. I saw this in my own family, but Alejandra dismisses as a matter of mere appearance or outmoded custom. She made a whisking motion with the imperfect hand that was both a dismissal and a summation. She composed her hands again and looked at him. Even though you are younger than she, it is not proper for you to be seen riding in the campo together without supervision. Since this was carried to my ears, I considered whether to speak to Alejandra about it, and I have decided not to. She leaned back. He could hear the clock ticking in the hall. There was no sound from the kitchen. She sat watching him. "What do you want me to do?" he said. "I want you to be considerate of a young girl's reputation." "I never meant not to be," she smiled. "I believe you," she said. "But you must understand, this is another country. Here a woman's reputation is all she has." "Yes, ma'am." "There is no forgiveness, you see." "Ma'am." "There is no forgiveness for women. A man may lose his honor and regain it again, but a woman cannot. She cannot." They sat. She watched him. He tapped the crown of his seat and hat with the tips of his four fingers and looked up. "I guess I'd have to say that don't seem right."
"Right?"
she said. "Oh, yes, well." She turned one hand in the air as if reminded of something she'd misplaced. "No," she said, "no. It's not a matter of right. You must understand, it's a matter of who must say. In this matter, I get to say. I am the one who gets to say." The clock ticked in the hall. She sat watching him. He picked up his hat. "Well, I guess I ought to say that you didn't have to invite me over just to tell me that."
"You're quite right," she said. "It was because of it that I almost didn't invite you."
On the mesa, they watched a storm that had made up to the north. At sundown, a troubled light. The dark jade shapes of the langoniers below them lay in the floor of the desert savanna like piercings through to another sky. The laminar bands of color to the west bleeding out under the hammered clouds. A sudden violet-colored hooding of the earth. They sat tailor-wise on ground that shuddered under the thunder, and they fed the fire out of the ruins of an old fence. Birds were coming down out of the half-darkness up-country, and shearing away off the edge of the mesa, and to the north the lightning stood along the rimlands like burning mandrake.
"What else did she say?" said Rawlins.
"That was about it."
"You think she was speaking for Rocha?"
"I don't think she speaks for anybody but her."
"She thinks you got eyes for the daughter."
"I do have eyes for the daughter."
"You got eyes for the spread?"
John Grady studied the fire. "I don't know," he said. "I ain't thought about it."
"Sure you ain't."
He looked at Rawlins and he looked into the fire again.
"When is she coming back?"
"About a week."
"I guess I don't see what evidence you got that she's all that interested in you,"
John Grady nodded. I'll just do. I can talk to her. The first drops of rain hissed in the fire. He looked at Rawlins.
You ain't sorry you come down here, are you?
Not yet.
He nodded. Rawlins rose.
You want your fish or you aim to just sit there in the rain?
I'll get it.
I got it.
They sat hooded under the slickers. They spoke out of the hoods as if addressing the night.
I know the old man likes you, said Rawlins, but that don't mean he'll sit still for you courting his daughter.
Yeah, I know.
I don't see you holding no aces.
Yeah.
But I see you fixing to get us fired and run off the place.
They watched the fire. The wire that had burned out of the fence posts lay in garbled shapes about the ground, and coils of it stood in the fire, and coils of it pulsed red-hot deep in the coals. The horses had come in out of the darkness and stood at the edge of the firelight in the falling rain, dark and sleek, with their red eyes burning in the night.
"You still ain't told me what answer you give her," said Rawlins.
"I told her I'd do whatever she asked."
"What did she ask?"
"I ain't sure."
They sat watching the fire.
"Did you give your word?" said Rawlins.
"I don't know. I don't know if I did or not."
"Well, either you did or you didn't."
"That's what I'd have thought, but I don't know." 5 nights later, asleep in his bunk in the barn, there was a tap at the door. He sat up. Someone was standing outside the door. He could see a light through the board joinings.
"Momento," he said.
He rose and pulled on his trousers in the dark and opened the door. She was standing in the barn bay, holding a flashlight in one hand with a light pointed at the ground.
"What is it?" he whispered.
"It's me." She held the light up as if to verify the truth of this. He couldn't think what to say.
"What time is it?"
"I don't know. 11 or something." He looked across the narrow corridor to the groom's door.
"We're going to wake Esteban," he said.
"Then invite me in." He stepped back, and she came in past him, all rustling of clothes and the rich parade of her hair and perfume. He pulled the door to and ran shut the wooden latch with the heel of his hand and turned and looked at her.
"I better not turn the light on," he said.
"It's all right. The generator's off anyway. What did she say to you?"
"She must have told you what she said."
"Of course she told me. What did she say?"
"You want to sit down?"
She turned and sat sideways on the bed and tucked one foot beneath her. She laid the burning flashlight on the bed, and then she pushed it under the blanket, where it suffused the room with a soft glow.
"She didn't want me to be seen with you, out on the campo.
Armando told her that you rode my horse in."
"I know.
I won't be treated in such a manner," she said. In that light she looked strange and theatrical. She passed one hand across the blanket as if she'd brushed something away. She looked up at him, and her face was pale and austere in the uplight, and her eyes lost in their darkly shadowed hollows, save only for the glint of them, and he could see her throat move in the light, and he saw in her face and in her figure something he'd not seen before, and the name of that thing was sorrow. "I thought you were my friend," she said. "Tell me what to do," he said. "I'll do anything you say." The night damp laid the dust going up the Cienega Road, and they rode the horses side by side at a walk, sitting the animals bareback and riding with hackamores. Leading the horses by hand out through the gate into the road and mounting up and riding the horses side by side up the Cienega Road with the moon in the west, and some dogs barking over toward the shearing sheds, and the greyhounds answering back from their pens, and him closing the gate and turning and holding his cupped hands for her to step into, and lifting her onto the black horse's naked back, and then untying the stallion from the gate and stepping once onto the gate slat, and mounting up all in one motion, and turning the horse and them riding side by side up the Cienega Road, with the moon in the west, like a moon of white linen hung from wires, and some dogs barking. They'd be gone sometimes till near daybreak, and he'd put the stallion up and go to the house for his breakfast.
and an hour later meet Antonio back at the stable and walk up past the gerente's house to the trap where the mare stood waiting. They'd ride at night up along the western mesa 2 hours from the ranch, and sometimes he'd build a fire, and they could see the gaslights at the hacienda gates far below them floating in a pool of black. And sometimes the light seemed to move as if the world down there turned on some other center, and they saw stars fall to earth by the hundreds, and she told him stories of her father's family and of Mexico. Going back, they'd walk the horses into the lake, and the horses would stand and drink with the water at their chests, and the stars in the lake bobbed and tilted where they drank, and if it rained in the mountains, the air would be close, and the night more warm, and one night he left her and rode down along the edge of the lake through the sedge and willow, and slid from the horse's back, and pulled off his boots and his clothes, and walked out into the lake where the moon slid away before him, and ducks gabbled out there in the dark. The water was black and warm, and he turned in the lake and spread his arms in the water, and the water was so dark and so silky, and he watched across the still black surface to where she stood on the shore with the horse. And he watched where she stepped from her pooled clothing, so pale, like a chrysalis emerging, and walked into the water. She paused midway to look back, standing there trembling in the water, and not from the cold, for there was none. Do not speak to her, do not call. When she reached him, he held out his hand, and she took it. She was so pale in the lake she seemed to be burning, like foxfire in a darkened wood that burned cold, like the moon that burned cold. Her black hair floating on the water about her, falling and floating on the water. She put her other arm about his shoulder and looked toward the moon in the west. Do not speak to her, do not call. And then she turned her face up to him. Sweeter for the larceny of time and flesh, sweeter for the betrayal. Nesting cranes that stood single-footed among the cane on the south shore had pulled their slender beaks from their wing-pits to watch. Me quieres? She said, yes, he said. He said her name. God, yes, he said. He came up from the barn, washed and combed and a clean shirt on, and he and Rollins sat on crates under the ramada of the bunkhouse and smoked while they waited for supper. There was talking and laughing in the bunkhouse, and then it ceased. Two of the vaqueros came to the door and stood. Rollins turned and looked north along the road. 5 Mexican rangers were coming down the road, riding single file. They were dressed in khaki uniforms, and they rode good horses, and they wore pistols and belt holsters and carried carbines in their saddle scabbards. Rollins stood. The other vaqueros had come to the door and stood looking out. As the riders passed on the road, the leader glanced across at the bunkhouse, at the men under the ramada, at the men standing in the door. Then they went on from sight past the gerente's house, 5 riders riding single file down out of the north, through the twilight toward the tile-roofed ranch house below them. When he came back down through the dark to the barn, the 5 horses were standing under the pecan trees at the far side of the house. They hadn't been unsaddled, and in the morning they were gone. The following night she came to his bed, and she came every night for 9 nights running, pushing the door shut and latching it and turning in the slatted light at God knew what hour, and stepping out of her clothes and sliding cool and naked against him in the narrow bunk, all softness and perfume and the lushness of her black hair falling over him and no caution to her at all. Saying, I don't care, I don't care, drawing blood with her teeth where he held the heel of his hand against her mouth that she did not cry out, sleeping against his chest where he could not sleep at all, and rising when the east was already gray with dawn,
and going to the kitchen to get her breakfast as if she were only up early. Then she was gone back to the city. The following evening, when he came in, he passed Esteban in the barn bay and spoke to the old man, and the old man spoke back, but did not look at him. He washed up and went to the house and ate his dinner in the kitchen, and after he'd eaten, he and the hacendado sat at the dining-room table and logged the stud book, and the hacendado questioned him and made notes on the mares, and then leaned back and sat smoking his cigar and tapping his pencil against the edge of the table. He looked up. "Good," he said. "How are you progressing with the Guzman?"
"Well, I'm not ready for volume 2.
The hacendado smiled. "Guzman is excellent. You don't read French?"
"No, sir. The bloody French are quite excellent on the subject of horses. Do you play billiards?"
"Sir?"
"Do you play billiards?"
"Oh, yes, sir, some. Pool, anyways."
"Pool, yes. Would you like to play?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good."
The hacendado folded shut the books and pushed back his chair and rose, and he followed him out down the hall and through the salon and through the library to the paneled double doors at the far end of the room. The hacendado opened these doors, and they entered a darkened room that smelled of must and old wood. He pulled a tasseled chain and lit an ornate tin chandelier suspended from the ceiling. Beneath it, an antique table of some dark wood with lions carved into the legs. The table was covered with a drop of yellow oilcloth, and the chandelier had been lowered from the 20-foot ceiling by a length of common trace chain. At the far end of the room was a very old carved and painted wooden altar, above which hung a life-size carved and painted wooden Christ. The hacendado turned. "I play seldom," he said. "I hope you are not an expert."
"No, sir."
"I asked Carlos if he could make the table more level. The last time we played it was quite crooked. We will see what has been done. Just take the corner there, I will show you." They stood on either side of the table and folded the cloth toward the middle and folded it again, and then lifted it away and took it past the end of the table and walked toward each other, and the hacendado took the cloth and carried it over and laid it on some chairs. "This was the chapel, as you see. You are not superstitious?"
"No, sir. I don't think so."
"It is supposed to be made unsacred. The priest comes and says some words. Alfonso knows about these matters, but of course the table has been here for years now, and the chapel has yet to be whatever the word is. To have the priest come and make it be no longer a chapel. Personally, I question whether such a thing can be done at all. What is sacred is sacred. The powers of the priest are more limited than people suppose. Of course, there has been no mass said here for many years."
"How many years?"
The hacendado was sorting through the queues where they stood, in and out of a mahogany rack in the corner. He turned.
"I received my first communion in this chapel. I suppose that may have been the last mass said here. I would say about 1911.
He turned back to the queues.
"I would not let the priest come to do that thing," he said. "To dissolve the sanctity of the chapel, why should I do that? I like to feel that God is here, in my house."
He racked the balls and handed the cue ball to John Grady. It was ivory and yellow with age, and the grain of the ivory was visible in it. He broke the balls, and they played straight pool, and the hacendado beat him easily, walking about the table and chalking his cue with a deft rotary motion and announcing the shots in Spanish. He played slowly and studied the shots and the lay of the table, and as he studied and as he played, he spoke of the revolution and of the history of Mexico, and he spoke of the Dueña Alfonso and of Francisco Madero.
"He was born in Paras, in this state. Our families at one time were quite close. Alfonsita may have been engaged to be married to Francisco's brother, I'm not sure. In any case, my grandfather would never have permitted the marriage. The political views of the family were quite radical. Alfonsita was not a child. She should have been left to make her own choice, and she was not. And whatever were the circumstances, she seems to have been very unforgiving of her father. And it was a great sorrow to him, and one that he was buried with. El Cuatro.
The hacendado bent and sighted and banked the four ball the length of the table and stood and chalked his cue. In the end, it was all of no consequence, of course. The family was ruined, both brothers assassinated. We studied the table. Like Madero, she was educated in Europe. Like him, she also learned these ideas, these... He moved his hand in a gesture the boy had seen the aunt make also. She has always had these ideas. Catorce. He bent and shot and stood and chalked his cue. He shook his head. One country is not another country. Mexico is not Europe. But it is a complicated business. Madera's grandfather was my padrino, my godfather, Don Evaristo. For this and other reasons, my grandfather remained loyal to him, which was not such a difficult thing. He was a wonderful man, very kind, loyal to the regime of Diaz, even that. When Francisco published his book, Don Evaristo refused to believe that he had written it, and yet the book contained nothing so terrible. Perhaps it was only that a wealthy young hacendado had written it. Siete. He bent and shot the seven ball into the side pocket. He walked around the table. They went to France for their education, he and Gustavo, and others, all these young people. They all returned full of ideas, and yet there seemed to be no agreement among them. How do you account for that? Their parents sent them for these ideas, no? And they went there and received them. Yet when they returned and opened their valises, so to speak, no two contained the same thing. He shook his head gravely, as if the lay of the table were a trouble to him. They were in agreement on matters of fact, the names of people or buildings, the dates of certain events, but ideas. The people of my generation are more cautious. I think we don't believe that people can be improved in their character by reason. That seems a very French idea. He chalked, he moved, he bent and shot and then stood surveying the new lay of the table. Beware, gentle knight, there is no greater monster than reason. He looked at John Grady and smiled, and looked at the table. That, of course, is the Spanish idea, you see, the idea of Quixote. But even Cervantes could not envision such a country as Mexico. Alfonsita tells me I am only being selfish in not wanting to send Alejandra. Perhaps she is right. Perhaps she is right. Diaz. Send her where? The hacendado had bent to shoot. He raised up again and looked at his guest. To France, to send her to France. He chalked his cue again. He studied the table. Why do I bother myself, eh? She will go. Who am I? A father. A father is nothing. He bent to shoot and missed his shot and stepped back from the table. There, he said. You see how this is bad for one's billiard game, this thinking? The French have come into my house to mutilate my billiard game. No evil is beyond them. He sat on his bunk in the dark with his pillow in his two arms, and he leaned his face into it and drank in her scent and tried to refashion in his mind herself and voice. He whispered half aloud the words she'd said. Tell me what to do. I'll do anything you say. The selfsame words he'd said to her. She'd wept against his naked chest while he held her, but there was nothing to tell her, and there was nothing to do. And in the morning she was gone. The following Sunday, Antonio invited him to his brother's house for dinner, and afterwards they sat in the shade of the Ramada off the kitchen and rolled a cigarette and smoked and discussed the horses. Then they discussed other things. John Grady told him of playing billiards with the hacendado and Antonio, sitting in an old Mennonite chair, the caning of which had been replaced with canvas, his hat on one knee and his hands together, received this news with the gravity proper to it, looking down at the burning cigarette and nodding his head. John Grady looked off through the trees toward the house, the white walls and the red clay roof tiles. Dígame, he said. ¿Cuál es lo peor? ¿Que soy pobre o que soy americano? The vaquero shook his head. Una llave de oro abre cualquier puerta, he said. He looked at the boy. He tipped the ash from the end of the cigarette, and he said that the boy wished to know his thought, wished perhaps his advice, but that no one could advise him.
Tienes razón, said John Grady.
He looked at the vaquero. He said that when she returned, he intended to speak to her with the greatest seriousness. He said that he intended to know her heart. The vaquero looked at him. He looked toward the house. He seemed puzzled and said that she was here, that she was here now.
¿Cómo? Sí, ella está aquí, desde ayer.
He lay awake all night until the dawn, listening to the silence in the bay, the shifting of the bedded horses, their breathing. In the morning he walked up to the bunkhouse to take his breakfast. Rollins stood in the door of the kitchen and studied him.
"You look like you've been rode hard and put up wet," he said.
They sat at the table and ate. Rollins leaned back and fished his tobacco out of his shirt pocket.
"I keep waiting for you to unload your wagon," he said. "I got to go to work here in a few minutes."
"I'll just come up to see you."
"What about?"
"It don't have to be about something, does it?"
"No, don't have to."
He popped a match on the underside of the table and lit his cigarette and shook out the match and put it in his plate.
"I hope you know what you're doing," he said.
John Grady drained the last of his coffee and put the cup on his plate along with the silver. He got his hat from the bench beside him and put it on and stood up to take his dishes to the sink.
"You said you didn't have no hard feelings about me going down there."
"I don't have no hard feelings about you going down there."
John Grady nodded.
"All right," he said.
Rollins watched him go to the sink and watched him go to the door. He thought he might turn and say something else, but he didn't. He worked with the mares all day, and in the evening he heard the airplane start up. He came out of the barn and watched. The plane came out of the trees and rose into the late sunlight and banked and turned and leveled out headed southwest. He couldn't see who was in the plane, but he watched it out of sight anyway. 2 days later, he and Rollins were in the mountains again. They rode hard, hazing the wild manadas out of the high valleys, and they camped at their old site on the south slope of the Anteojos, where they had camped with Luis, and they ate beans and barbecued goat meat wrapped in tortillas and drank black coffee.
"We ain't got many more trips up here, have we?" said Rollins.
John Grady shook his head.
"No," he said, "probably not."
Rollins sipped his coffee and watched the fire. Suddenly 3 greyhounds trotted into the light, one behind the other, and circled the fire, pale and skeletal shapes with the hide stretched taut over their ribs and their eyes red in the firelight. Rollins half rose, spilling his coffee.
"What in the hell?" he said.
John Grady stood and looked out into the darkness. The dogs vanished as suddenly as they had come. They stood waiting. No one came.
"What the hell?" said Rollins.
He walked out a little ways from the fire and stood listening. He looked back at John Grady.
"You want to holler?"
"No."
"Them dogs ain't up here by themselves," he said.
"I know."
"You think he's hunting us?"
"If he wants us, he can find us."
Rollins walked back to the fire. He poured fresh coffee and stood listening.
"He's probably up here with a bunch of his buddies."
John Grady didn't answer.
"Don't you reckon?" said Rollins.
They rode up to the catch pen in the morning, expecting to come upon the hacendado and his friends, but they did not come upon him. In the days that followed, they saw no sign of him. 3 days later, they set off down the mountain, herding before them 11 young mares, and they reached the hacienda at dark and put the mares up and went to the bunkhouse and ate. Some of the vaqueros were still at the table, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes, but one by one they drifted away. The following morning at gray daybreak, 2 men entered his cubicle with drawn pistols and put a flashlight in his eyes and ordered him to get up. He sat up. He swung his legs over the edge of the bunk. The man holding the light was just a shape behind it, but he could see the pistol he held. It was a Colt automatic service pistol. He shaded his eyes. There were men with rifles standing in the bay.
¿Quién es? He said.
The man swung the light at his feet and ordered him to get his boots and clothes. He stood and got his trousers and pulled them on, and sat and pulled on his boots and reached and got his shirt.
—Vámonos,
said the man. He stood and buttoned his shirt.
—¿Dónde están sus armas?
The man said.
—No tengo armas.
He spoke to the man behind him, and two men came forward and began to look through his things. They dumped out the wooden coffee box on the floor and kicked through his clothes and his shaving things, and they turned the mattress over in the floor. They were dressed in greasy and blackened khaki uniforms, and they smelled of sweat and wood smoke.
—¿Dónde está su caballo?
—En el segundo puesto.
—Vámonos, vámonos.
They led him out down the bay to the saddle room, and he got his saddle and his blankets, and by then Red Bow was standing in the barn bay, stepping nervously. They came back past Esteban's cuarto, but there was no sign that the old man was even awake. They held the light while he saddled his horse, and then they walked out into the dawn where the other horses were standing. One of the guards was carrying Rawlins' rifle, and Rawlins was sitting slumped in the saddle on his horse with his hands cuffed before him and the reins on the ground. They jabbed him forward with a rifle.
"What's this about, partner?" he said.
Rawlins didn't answer. He leaned and spat and looked away.
"No hable," said the leader. "Vámonos."
He mounted up, and they cuffed his wrists and handed him the reins, and then all mounted up, and they turned their horses and rode two by two out of the lot through the standing gate. When they passed the bunkhouse, the lights were on, and the vaqueros were standing in the door or squatting along the ramada. They watched the riders pass, the Americans behind the leader and his lieutenant, the others, six in number, riding in pairs behind in their caps and uniforms, with their carbines resting across the pommels of their saddles, all riding out along the Cienega Road and up country toward the north. Part 3. They rode all day, up through the low hills and into the mountains and along the mesa to the north, well beyond the horse range, and into the country they'd first crossed into some 4 months before. They nooned at a spring and squatted about the cold and blackened sticks of some former fire and ate cold beans and tortillas out of a newspaper. He thought the tortillas could have come from the hacienda kitchen. The newspaper was from Monclova. He ate slowly with his manacled hands and drank water from a tin cup that could only be partly filled for the water running out through the rivet holding the handle. The brass showed through the nickel plating where it was worn from the inside of the cuffs, and his wrists had already turned a pale and poisonous green. He ate, and he watched Rawlins, who squatted a little ways off, but Rawlins would not meet his eyes. They slept briefly on the ground under the cottonwoods, and then rose and drank more water and filled the canteens and water bottles and rode on. The country they traversed was advanced in season, and the acacia was in bloom, and there had been rain in the mountains, and the grass along the selve edge of the draws was green and blowsy in the long twilight where they rode. Except for remarks concerning the countryside, the guards said little among themselves, and to the Americans they said nothing at all. They rode through the long red sunset, and they rode on in the dark. The guards had long since scabbarded their rifles, and they rode easily, half slouched in the saddle. About 10 o'clock they halted and made camp and built a fire. The prisoners sat in the sand among old rusted tins and bits of charcoal with their hands still manacled before them, and the guards set out an old blue graniteware coffee pot and a stew pot of the same material, and they drank coffee and ate a dish containing some kind of pale and fibrous tuber, some kind of meat, some kind of fowl, all of it stringy, all of it sour. They spent the night with their hands chained through the stirrups of their saddles, trying to keep warm under their single blankets. They were on the trail again before the sun was up an hour, and glad to be so. This was their life for 3 days. On the afternoon of the third, they rode into the town of Encantada, of recent memory. They sat side by side on a bench of iron slats in the little Alameda. The pair of the guards stood a little ways off with their rifles, and a dozen children of different ages stood in the dust of the street watching them.
Two of the children were girls about 12 years of age, and when the prisoners looked at them, they turned shyly and twisted at their skirts. John Grady called to them to ask if they could get them cigarettes. The guards glared at him. He made smoking motions at the girls, and they turned and ran off down the street. The other children stood as before.
"Ladies, man," said Rollins. "You don't want a cigarette?"
Rollins spat slowly between his boots and looked up again. "They ain't going to bring you no damn cigarette," he said.
"I'll bet you."
"What the hell you going to bet with?"
"I'll bet you a cigarette."
"How you going to do that?"
"I'll bet you a cigarette she brings them. If she brings them, I keep yours."
"What are you going to give me if she don't bring them?"
"If she don't bring them, then you get mine."
Rollins stared out across the Alameda.
"I ain't above whipping your ass, you know."
"Don't you think if we're going to get out of this jackpot, we might better start thinking about how to get out of it together?"
"You mean like we got in it?"
"Well, you don't get to go back and pick some time when the trouble started and then lay everything off on your friend." Rollins didn't answer.
"Don't sull up on me. Let's get it aired."
"All right. When they arrested you, what did you say?"
"I didn't say nothing. What would have been the use?"
"That's right. What would have been the use?"
"What does that mean?"
"It means you never asked him to go wake the patron, did you?"
"No."
"I did."
"What did they say?"
Rollins leaned and spat and wiped his mouth. "They said he was awake. They said he'd been awake for a long time. Then they laughed."
"You think he sold us down the river?"
"Don't you?"
"I don't know. If he did, it was because of some lie."
"Or some truth."
John Grady sat looking down at his hands.
"Would it satisfy you," he said, "if I was to just go on and admit to being a 14-carat gold-plated son of a bitch?"
"I never said that."
They sat. After a while, John Grady looked up. "I can't back up and start over. But I don't see the point in slobbering over it. And I can't see where it would make me feel better to be able to point a finger at somebody else."
"It don't make me feel better. I tried to reason with you, that's all. I tried any number of times."
"I know you did. But some things ain't reasonable. Be that as it may, I'm the same man you crossed that river with. How I was is how I am, and all I know to do is stick. I never even promised you you wouldn't die down here. Never asked your word on it either. I don't believe in signing on just till it quits suiting you. You either stick or you quit, and I wouldn't quit you. I don't care what you done. And that's about all I got to say."
"I never quit you," Rollins said.
"All right." After a while, the two girls came back. The taller of them held up her hand with two cigarettes in it. John Grady looked at the guards. They motioned the girls over and looked at the cigarettes and nodded, and the girls approached the bench and handed the cigarettes to the prisoners together with several wooden matches.
"Muy amable," said John Grady. "Muchas gracias."
They lit the cigarettes off one match, and John Grady put the other matches in his pocket and looked at the girls. They smiled shyly.
"Son americanos ustedes?" they said.
"Sí."
"Son ladrones?"
"Sí. Ladrones muy famosos. Bandoleros."
They sucked in their breath.
"Qué precioso," they said.
But the guards called to them and waved them away. They sat leaning forward on their elbows, smoking the cigarettes. John Grady looked at Rollins' boots.
"Where's them new boots at?" he said.
"Back at the bunkhouse." He nodded. They smoked. After a while, the others returned and called to the guards. The guards gestured at the prisoners, and they rose and nodded to the children and walked out to the street. They rode out through the north end of the town, and they halted before an adobe building with a corrugated tin roof and an empty mud bell cot above it. Scales of old painted plaster still clung to the mud brick walls. They dismounted and entered a large room that might once have been a schoolroom. There was a rail along the front wall and a frame that could once have held a blackboard.
The floors were of narrow pine boards, and the grain was etched by years of sand trod into them, and the windows along both walls had missing panes of glass replaced with squares of tin, all cut from the same large sign to form a broken mosaic among the window lights. At a gray metal desk in one corner sat a stout man, likewise in khaki uniform, who wore